This is an ABC podcast.
Nisan Bolivinaka, Maloni and Kiorana. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. On the show today, there are four deaths confirmed in Samoa as continuous dengue fever cases rise across the Pacific. Will Taiwan be allowed to participate at the next Pacific Islands Forum? And what is the future of Tonga's Sevens team? That and more coming up on the show. I'm your host, Aggie Dubow, and I say whakawhetai lasi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Solomon Islands could try to defuse a potentially explosive stoush over Taiwan's participation in a key regional meeting next month by restricting the gathering to Pacific Islands Forum members, effectively excluding China, the US and a host of other countries as well. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele has been coming under increasing pressure over whether his country will allow Taiwan's representatives to attend the Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting in Honiara this September. Now, the ABC has been told Mr. Manele is likely to propose to fellow Pacific leaders that the annual dialogue with PIF partners be deferred entirely. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgett spoke with Massey University Associate Professor Anna Poles, who says while this compromise could avoid a conflict, it sets a worrying precedent.
This is the worrying issue here, is that to what degree are non-Pacific Island Forum member countries, to what degree are they influencing very fundamental procedural aspects of the way in which the forum is conducted, namely who gets to attend. And given that Taiwan's attendance was effectively sort of codified in the 1992 Honiara communique, this type of disruption is deeply worrying. And unfortunately, even if this is the best solution, the best compromise, it simply kicks the can down the road to Palau, who will host the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting in 2026 and is an ally of Taiwan.
What does the forum need to do then to ensure that this circus doesn't continue? Do they need to reach a new public reaffirmation over the status quo, or at least some sort of new formulation which every state can live with?
Well, I think part of the solution will hopefully stem from the review of the regional architecture, which is was mandated to effectively deliver the 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific in the most effective way. The review of the regional architecture is one of the reasons why Prime Minister Manele has potentially been able to point to the option of not inviting foreign dialogue partners, because there's the business of the review of the regional architecture to deal with and to agree upon at this meeting. And a part of that is to actually review the political groupings, including the dialogue partner groupings, and to determine who fits into Tier 1 and Tier 2 categories. Now, that in itself is going to be, potentially a contentious issue. But in terms of the types of options, there are two things that need to be resolved. Firstly, what is the role of all dialogue partners and development partners, and that's the category that Taiwan is under, and how are their roles protected and upheld within the regional architecture and regional arrangements, but also how does the Pacific Islands Forum, as the preeminent regional political body, how does it manage this type of geopolitical contestation in the region? How does it manage these types of issues in order to ensure that they don't become disruptive and they don't co-opt the forum agenda?
As you mentioned, I think Mr. Manele is likely to sort of gesture towards that review of regional architecture. He might also point to the fact that Fiji hosted its own meeting in 2022 and no dialogue partners were invited to that one either. Do you think that, two questions, I guess. One, I mean, do you think it's really just a convenient sort of procedural veil that he can draw over what is basically a political decision? And two, do you think it's reasonable to point to that 22 precedent in Fiji?
Look, I do, actually. I mean, I think on both counts, it does offer quite a convenient veil, as you say. But it also, if we cast our minds back to 2022, and you know, the reason was that, you know, post-COVID, there was a lot of issues to be discussed. The decision was made that the foreign leaders meeting could really do without the jockeying and currying for favour that goes on amongst all the different dialogue partners. And because we've seen such an uptick in numbers of countries who are seeking dialogue partner status, and that in itself has become quite a distraction from sort of the core business of regionalism, effectively. So I actually think that this is quite a fair approach to take. Maybe they need to consider actually holding the annual dialogue partners meeting at a separate time to the leaders meeting, so we're not seeing the type of issues that arose in the Cook Islands and at other times where that the competition between, say, China and Taiwan has cast a shadow over the events and dominated the headlines, when actually there's far more important business to be focused on. So I think that this is also an opportunity to really think through whether or not it's manageable and whether or not it is the best option to hold both leaders meeting and dialogue meetings at the same time, or whether or not they should actually be clearly separated.
Do you think this proposal is likely to fly? Because, of course, it's been proposed by Mr. Manele. I'm told it's also been put to the Troika leaders, but it's still got to get backing from other Pacific leaders. And, of course, there is always the possibility that either the US or China or Taiwan might respond furiously to the proposal when it's put out there. Do you think that this will work, or is it possible that it's simply an invitation to more controversy?
Well, it's really, really hard to tell. I think it's all going to depend on the way that this proposal is delivered. I think basing it around the need to make some key decisions with respect to the review of the regional architecture, but also with respect to the proposed Ocean of Peace Declaration. Now, these are really important sort of normative and very practical decisions that need to be made for the region about about what type of region we want to see. And I think that if it can be painted in that way and portrayed in that way, then perhaps there will be agreement. I don't think any Pacific leader wants to see this turn into you know, any type of sort of diplomatic stoush, as you mentioned at the top. I think everyone will understand that Prime Minister Manele is looking for the best option because, of course, you know, the last thing that any Prime Minister wants is for the leaders' meeting that his country hosts to be in any way controversial. So there'll be a lot of support for what he's trying to navigate, but also it needs to be done in such a way that it doesn't feed into those existing divisions within the region already, and it doesn't amplify those.
And that's Massey University Associate Professor Anna Poles on the diplomatic manoeuvring ahead of the upcoming Pacific Islands Forum meeting in Honiara. And she was speaking to the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Gidgets. Now, the death toll across the Pacific continues to grow amid the region's dengue fever outbreak. In Samoa, there have been 4 confirmed deaths and 1 probable death, and more than 5,000 cases since the start of the year. Nauru's health department has also confirmed 2 deaths, both children. I spoke earlier to the World Health Organization's Pacific Technical Support Director, Dr. Mark Jacobs, on why numbers are on the rise across the Pacific.
reports. And what we're seeing this year is that it's the biggest number of cases that we've seen being reported, certainly in the last 10 years, if not more. So far this year, we've had 20,689 suspected dengue cases reported. So they're cases where it looks like dengue symptoms and they get reported through a reporting system for that, but they haven't had a laboratory test. For laboratory confirmed cases, we've had 13,797 confirmed cases.
Why is that then?
What we tend to see in the Pacific, and this is a long-term pattern, is that across the region, we'll have some years where we get a big peak in cases, and then other years, it's very much lower levels, and a lot of the Pacific countries don't see any cases at all. The peak years, they tend to happen every 2 or 3 years, something like that. Why we get the peak in 1 year rather than another, we don't really know for sure. There's lots of things that could play a part. So why the individual country might get an outbreak in a particular year. One is that there could be issues, you know, with weather, so temperature and rainfall that can impact the number of mosquitoes that are around. But for a lot of the Pacific countries, the biggest factor is whether somebody who's infected with dengue comes into the country and then the local mosquitoes bite them and spread it. Because the dengue virus is only found in two types of animal, mosquitoes and people. And so you need people with dengue who then infect the mosquitoes, and then those infected mosquitoes then infect more people. That's how epidemics happen, how outbreaks happen. For most of the time, they'll have no dengue around. There'll be no dengue in people, no dengue in the mosquitoes, and it takes an infected person coming into that country to then infect the local mosquitoes, and then it can take off.
Right across the Pacific, there's been quite a few outbreaks being declared. One of them, obviously, is Samoa. Do you believe then, even with Samoa's health system, that they are ready to deal with a possible surge?
Any health system around the world can be stretched when there's epidemics. Most of the Pacific countries have got quite small health systems, and so they can definitely be affected if there's an epidemic of dengue. But what the Pacific also has are health systems and health professionals that are very used to being flexible. And I know Samoa, for instance, has had to set up a special ward for dengue cases, which doesn't normally exist, but they've repurposed a whole ward in the hospital for this purpose.
Doctor, I want to head to Nauru too, because, you know, again, they've reported two deaths and it's children again. And on top of that, it's even been reported 9 asylum seekers have contracted dengue fever. What's the message to those who are going in country to these Pacific nations and are not aware of the cases that are happening?
Well, the first thing to say about dengue risk for travellers is that a lot of the world is a risk for dengue. So WHO estimates about half the world's population are living in areas where there is a dengue risk. Where people are planning travel, if you're travelling to a place that's got, you know, a dengue risk or a current dengue outbreak, then the things that are important to know are the same things that's important for the locals to know. Because if you don't get bitten by mosquitoes, you don't get dengue. So reduce your risk of being bitten by mosquitoes, and then also knowing what severe dengue symptoms look like. Because most people who get dengue don't get sick at all. But then for the people who get sick, it's very unpleasant. After a week or so, people will start getting over it, and then really they just get treated just for their symptoms. A small proportion can get very severe dengue, and that's when it becomes life-threatening. One of the important things is if people get some of those symptoms, and that's indication they do need to go and see a doctor, because early treatment of severe dengue can make a big difference to what the outcome of that is.
Yeah, and that's the thing. What are the specific symptoms we're looking out for? I mean, is it just like a common cold, just a little bit worse than that? And then on top of that, I mean, who really is at greatest risk of contracting dengue?
They very commonly get a high temperature, so 40 degrees Celsius, that sort of temperature, and get severe headaches. They can get things like pain behind the eyes, aching muscles and joints. They can feel nauseous. They can vomit, and they can get a rash. So the signs that might indicate that someone might be developing severe dengue may often come on once the fever has gone away. People might be thinking, oh, I'm getting better, but then they start getting some other symptoms. So it might be they get a really bad stomach pain, or they might be vomiting a lot, or they might be breathing really rapidly, or they might start bleeding from their gums or from their nose, or there might be blood in their bowel motions or in their vomit. They might feel super tired, or they might be restless. They might get really pale, cold skin, or feel very, very thirsty. So any of those sort of symptoms, if you've already had symptoms of dengue, you do need to go off to see a health professional just in case. And the question that you asked about who is really being most affected, it has four different types. You call them type 1, type 2, type 3, and type 4. If you've been infected with dengue type 1, then once you recover from that, you're then protected against getting that type of dengue again. But if one of these other types then comes into the country, you can be infected with that other type of dengue, and it's people getting dengue more than once that are most at risk of getting severe dengue. The people that most often get sick with dengue in outbreaks, in many of the outbreaks, is children. Because yeah. they haven't previously been infected, and that's certainly what we've been seeing so far in Samoa.
Again, what would be just the standard messaging, for our region to really be aware, rather find the solutions? What's the prevention?
Now, the mosquitoes that spread dengue, they live locally. They'll only travel 100 metres or 200 metres in their lives. The precautions you take around your house can make a big difference. You know, wearing clothes that cover up a lot of your body, because if the mosquitoes can't get at your skin, they can't bite you. Wear insect repellents. Use coils around your house. If you've got screens around your house, be aware that the time when these types of mosquitoes bite you, it's not at night time, it's during the day. And particularly the first few hours after the sun's come up and the last few hours before the sun goes down. That's the peak biting time for these mosquitoes. The other thing is that these mosquitoes breed very easily around our houses. So they'll breed in a small amount of water and a bit of rubbish that's left at the back of the garden, or they'll breed in small amounts of water that some of the palm trees collect, those sort of things. And so everybody, really doing a good clean-up around their houses to try to get rid of anything that might collect water, those things will make a big difference to people and their risk of dengue.
And that's the World Health Organization's Pacific Technical Support Director, Dr. Mark Jacobs.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia rana and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thibault. We head to the Cook Islands, where today marks the 60th anniversary of the nation's self-governance and free association with New Zealand. Despite the celebrations and festivities, though, tension between the two is at a high. After Cook Islands' decision to sign a comprehensive strategic partnership with China earlier this year, it has raised continued questions from its closest neighbour, New Zealand, who said the island nation was not open and transparent about its international agreements and has now paused its foreign aid. We have political analyst William Numanga, who is on the line and joins us to discuss this more. That I say, bonpongi mania, William, and welcome to the show.
Kia rana, Agnes. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I appreciate you joining us this morning. I mean, firstly, happy 60th anniversary of the Cook Islands Constitution. Would like to know, what does this mean for you and fellow cookies?
Well, it's a symbolic time. This milestone is not just ceremonial, it symbolises political maturity for the Cook Islands. You know, it's our evolving international legal personality, and it shows that we're growing economically and our diplomatic independence is also growing. So it's a great time to celebrate. 60 years anniversary marks a major constitutional milestone for us, and especially our relationship with New Zealand. It just reaffirms our Cook Island identity as a self-governing state and a right to manage our own affairs while enjoying the close relationship with New Zealand.
William, I understand, and you talk about, the 60 years of the maturity of how Cook Islands have grown over the years. But, we talk about New Zealand and Cook Islands and their deep history, right? But I'm wondering, yes, what is the feeling on the ground, though, at the moment, since, there are tensions between New Zealand and Cook Islands, especially since New Zealand's Prime Minister declined to come through to those celebrations?
Yes, the absence of top executive-level leadership sends a symbolic message, one that appears to downplay the strength or the priority of the relationship, especially at a time of geopolitical sensitivity. Overall, I think the atmosphere, the vibe that's on the ground right now is a very positive one. It's a time of celebration. Yes, we take note of the absence of these top-level executives from New Zealand, but we've also enjoyed the presence of other top-level people from around the Pacific. We also welcome Dame Cindy Kiro, the Governor-General of New Zealand. So the absence of the Prime Minister of New Zealand and some of his officials at that level has not really dampened the spirits, but it does send a message.
Okay, and I know part of that message was that New Zealand had paused, you know, millions of dollars of financial assistance to the Cook Islands because of that, you know, strategic agreement that was signed with China. Again, your thoughts, what impact is this pause having on the Cooks?
Yes, the impact is that there are some projects and some funding arrangements or funding that was organised from the aid, and so I think those will be impacted, particularly the outer islands. I know there were some projects that were earmarked with that funding in place, but it also, you know, sends a clear warning. Failure to consult on foreign relation matters, particularly concerning major powers like China, carries consequences. And I think that's the message that we could see from this pause from New Zealand. But I know it's an opportunity for us to re-engage back with New Zealand, and hopefully we can restore that trust. I know it can be done, and it's just a matter of making the time and commitment to do so.
William, I want to go back to 2020 because, you know, Cook Islands had graduated, right, from the developing country status. And when this happens, how much pressure then is there to sort of diversify aid and investment partners? Because I'm sure many are asking, how does then China fit into that?
But China has existed in its relationship with the Cook Islands way before the Cook Islands graduated to development status or to developed status. And so that hasn't changed. We have received assistance and aid from China prior to that. They've helped build some of our key infrastructure. We had a tripartite agreement with New Zealand, China, and the Cook Islands to build our water infrastructure in Rarotonga. And so the graduated status, yes, it does restrict us from accessing aid that we used to, but what it does, it just allows us to forge new partnerships, establish new connections, and potentially look inward within the country to see how we can strengthen revenue-generating opportunities. We've got a shipping service that we're about to start. Mm. There's a possibility of that being a more self-sustaining service, and probably wrapping that into an SOE setup, even though that hasn't been committed to at this time. So I think the country, yes, it has graduated to develop status. However, we still have to recognize the fact that we are vulnerable, you know, as a small nation in the open Pacific to climate change. We are vulnerable to external shocks with tourism. Mm. And so we still have to be engaging with other partners. We have to engage with multilateral banks, the ADB, and other partners around the world to seek assistance if and when we need, just in case we get hit by different things that we have no control over.
Mm. And yeah, let's talk about the relationships, because how critical is it for Cook Islanders that the relationship with New Zealand does stay strong? And also, is it possible for Cook Islands to have a relationship with both New Zealand and China?
I think we've demonstrated from the water project that it can be. It's a tripartite agreement where three key partners were working together to get water infrastructure improved in Rarotonga. So definitely there's an opportunity to get that done. The relationship with New Zealand is always one that we value and we treasure. We have close to 100,000 people in New Zealand that they make New Zealand their home, Cook Islanders. And so we're not in any position, or we do not want to jeopardize that relationship just because of a misunderstanding at the diplomatic level. So I think there's opportunity to be able to address that.
Yeah. And look, let's go back to the celebrations of today. Let's not dampen the day itself. But, you know, for yourself, how are you going to celebrate, William? And then also, looking ahead, what does the next 60 years of relationship between Cook Islands and New Zealand look like?
Well, I'm going to celebrate it with family and spending time with friends and family. But looking ahead for 60 years, I think we're at a very critical time with all the geopolitical activity that's happening in the region, in the Pacific. We just have to be prepared for whatever global shocks and tensions that take place. As a small nation, we have resources at our disposal. We've got a thriving tourism industry. So I personally think going forward for the next 60 years, there is opportunity for us to strengthen economically. If we want to flex our muscle to be a lot more independent politically, we have to be economically independent. And so we are a long way off from that. I don't want to speculate or anticipate any future events, but I think there's an opportunity for us to continue to grow. We just have to tighten up a few things and strengthen our systems, build capacity. We got to work on our population. We have a declining population. We have a transient population that continues to exit into New Zealand and Australian markets. And so we got to figure out ways to manage that, to attract our people to come home, and especially to populate our pāinua. A lot of our remote islands in the north and south, we see a declining population. The shipping service that we are hoping to start with two new boats from China and Japan would hopefully provide assistance to allow our people to go back and make a life back in their home islands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited for the future, for the next 60 years. I hope I'm still around for another 60 years to celebrate that milestone. But we want to be able to leave a healthy economic and political state for the future of our country and our kids. And we got to do that now. And I think I have confidence in our leadership. I have confidence in our people, our private sector, that if we collaborate and work together, we can have a solid years of growth and prosperity for the next 10, 20, up to 60 years.
That's beautiful. William, look, that's all the time that we have for today, and we do really appreciate that you've come on the show just to share about the relationship between Aotearoa New Zealand and Rarotonga. But me taki ma'ata, hopefully you enjoy the rest of today.
Thank you, Agnes. I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
No worries. That is political analyst William Lumanga.
Pacific Beat.
Well, Australia and the US have wrapped the largest military operation in the Southern Hemisphere, with parts of the exercise held in Papua New Guinea for the first time. Exercise Talisman Sabre is developed bilaterally with the US and involves all three branches of Australia's Defence Force, along with thousands of military personnel from 19 invited nations. The three-week-long exercise has wrapped in Lae, and the ABC's PNG correspondent Marion Farm has this report.
In remote Papua New Guinea, these US gunmen are celebrating a successful mission. Their job, working with the ADF and the PNG Defence Force, was to rescue Air Force pilots from a simulated crash.
In a complex environment, jungles, swamps, rivers, the key to survival in that environment is collaboration and working together.
For the first time, part of the joint Australian and US war games, known as Talisman Sabre, was held offshore. In northern Australia, the ADF tested its newest long-range missiles, capable of striking targets more than 500 kilometres away.
While there are important practical reasons for these exercises, they're also about optics, demonstrating military strength and allegiances at a time of increasing geopolitical competition.
China has probably been surveilling these exercises in many and varied ways. We've not seen any intelligence ships come down to our region on this one.
Being on Australia's doorstep makes Papua New Guinea one of the most strategically important countries in the Pacific, and that's reflected in spending. Next week, Defence Minister Richard Marles will travel to PNG to gift a newly refurbished naval base on Manus Island a $175 million investment. And the two countries are in the midst of negotiating a bilateral defence treaty.
This treaty will allow Papua New Guinean citizens to serve in the ADF and Australian citizens to also come and serve in PNGDF.
Friends and allies investing in the region and each other.
And that's the ABC's PNG correspondent, Marin Farr, speaking there. Your news rep, it's up next. Malo Lele, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, we head around the region now to get your latest headlines. That's brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's in the studio live with me. How you doing, man?
Good morning, Aggie. I'm doing well today.
Tuesday. I'm doing well. Thank you very much. Leah, let's get straight into it. We head to Tonga because I believe two members of the Tongan Legislative Assembly have been suspended from Parliament after tensions boiled over. What happened there?
Yeah, that's right. So Tonga's Minister for Police, Paveni Puikala, who's actually been on the show a couple of times, as well as a Nobles representative, Lord Tuila Kepa, they've been banished after an argument turned physical, according to reports from the Matangi Tonga. So this apparently occurred on Friday when former PM Siose Sovaleni and two other MPs raised concerns over the urgency of a money laundering and crime bill. Lord Tuila Kepa agreed with those concerns, which led to a heated exchange with Minister Puikala, who obviously took exception to what was said. And according to reports, the speaker then turned off the live broadcast for about a minute. And when it resumed, the police minister was heard threatening to hit the noble before he was escorted out by the Master of Arms. Now, the Assembly has since released a statement confirming that the altercation did turn physical for a period. And as a result, both men will now take a short leave of absence.
But I'd like to know, how long is their suspension for?
So not too long. They'll both be back this Friday. Until then, they'll be excluded from parliamentary proceedings and they won't receive a portion of their salary, just while they cool down for a period,
I guess. I was
going
to say, I have heard a little bit of portion of that argument that was online. We'll just leave it at that. The US Defense Department, though, they've released details of projects they're carrying out in Yap and FSM. What are they?
Yeah, so these are in relation to proposed airport and seaport projects, both of which have been touted as infrastructure upgrades, which the US has to date been somewhat tight-lipped about. And according to the Pacific Island Times, these projects are going to allow US military aircraft and vessels to enter the island. So once complete, they'll be used to transport cargo, things like fighter planes, as well as hold twice yearly military exercises with approximately 100 military personnel. That being said, the US, they're not calling it a base. They say they are upgrades to support their own access, as is their right under the COFA agreements. But much like Tinny and Aggie, if you do read between the lines, it does represent a larger significance. In that if a major conflict were to break out in the region, it gives the US a lot of flexibility to disperse forces and basically says to any other would-be adversaries that if you want to take us on, we have another staging ground for which we can deploy forces from.
All right. Let's head to sport, though. The British and Irish Lions, they've confirmed they are considering adding additional matches to their next test tour. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I might have manifested this one, to be honest.
No, of course you did.
The organisation's chief executive said matches against the likes of Fiji and Japan will be considered ahead of the Lions' next test series against New Zealand, which is going to take place in 4 years' time. So according to reports, the Lions are looking at ways to make their tour more competitive, and that's after they were actually disappointed at the standard of opposition in the lead-up to the series with Australia. You might remember they played a few Super Rugby teams in the lead-up to that Australian series, and basically, they won those games easily, but that was due largely to the fact that the Wallabies withheld a lot of their stars and prevented them from playing in those for their Super Rugby Pacific teams to, you know, prevent them from getting injury and whatnot. In fact, the Lions' biggest challenge outside of the Wallabies would have been the Indigenous and Pacific of 15, who, you know, really gave them a run for their money in Melbourne. So essentially, because of that, the Lions are looking at expanding their horizons to other international sides for their next tour. However, those matches would only take place in New Zealand, Australia, or South Africa, meaning a team like Japan or New Zealand would have to travel to those countries.
Of course. But look, as always, I'm 100% behind our Pacific people when they are out there playing sport. I don't know what it is, but they just bring an extra flair to the game.
They do.
Carl, thank you so much for bringing our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Good fella morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We take you now to Balao, where hidden behind limestone cliffs lie strange saltwater lakes that are home to ecological wonders, including a species of golden jellyfish now found nowhere else on Earth. But after a mass disappearance, scientists, guides and local communities are working together to uncover what went wrong and whether these fragile creatures are finally making a return. In a new episode of The Pacific Scientific, reporter Sophie Lee travels to Balao to speak with the country's jellyfish lady, Sharon Petrus.
For about 2 years, we went to all the schools in Palau and we just took them to Jellyfish Lake. And we said, come learn about your important natural marine resource and learn science with us, but also learn about this important habitat that's found nowhere else in the world and that you should be really proud of having here in Palau. So we had a lot of fun with these kids. And hopefully they still remember us because we still see some kids and they look at us like, hey, it's the jellyfish lady. I just laugh about it. I'm like, yeah, that's right. I work with Jellyfish Lake.
Sharon's hair is graying slightly and her wise eyes light up as she tells me about her career. When she first started in marine biology, she traveled to the US to study, as many Palauans do. But not everyone returns home though. But Sharon did.
Nothing beats home in Palau. That's the best part about studying and doing research here in Palau. The ocean is literally right outside our door.
For the last 20 years, she's been monitoring the lakes and studying the iconic golden jellyfish, an endemic species found only in Palau. That has some pretty unique quirks. With minimal predators in the lake, their stings have evolved extremely weakly, with only enough zap to capture their food, and they are harmless to humans. They also move differently. Instead of moving with the shifting currents of the ocean, isolated inside the lake, they follow the sun.
They have a migration pattern that goes from the east when the sun is rising, and then they turn around and start actively swimming to the west as the sun sets.
The solar rays feed an algae-like organism called zooxanthellae, which lives in the jelly's tissue and gives them energy. And also, their golden color.
So they have stinging cells that catch zooplankton, which they eat, but they also have algae in their tissue that they use for photosynthesis. And then they get their nutrition from that algae as well.
Sharon explains that in the early 2000s, the population of the golden jellyfish got as high as 32 million. But recently, the numbers have not been good.
So when we go into the lakes, we mostly measure the temperature, salinity and oxygen, but we also count the golden jellyfish. But we do have stations that are evenly distributed throughout the lake. And at those stations, we drop a net. And then whatever we catch in those nets, we count them and then we estimate an average across the lake. And in the last couple of years, we've had very few jellyfish in the lake.
But turns out this isn't the first time the jellyfish have disappeared. Almost 30 years ago, in 1997, a similar situation happened.
And that's when our research actually started, because people were concerned about the golden jellyfish disappearing. There are a lot of ideas thrown out, including people were blaming it on the tourists, saying, oh, they pee in the lake, so the pee must be killing the golden jellyfish.
Was it pee? Or was it something else? The Coral Reef Research Foundation set off for Jellyfish Lake to figure it out.
they found that connection between the golden jellyfish and the seawater temperature. They said, oh, it's related to the water temperature.
To be clear, not from the pee. Instead, it's the climate.
Most of the times they disappeared is because the lake got too hot.
More specifically, it was an El Niño event, when global weather patterns result in a lack of rain in the Pacific. Typically, an El Niño event is followed by a La Niña weather pattern, which brings more rain to the Pacific region. As the weather pattern stabilized, the jellyfish population recovered. But in 2016, there was another, more extreme El Niño event that led to drought, and jellyfish once again began to disappear. This time, Koroa's traditional leaders and chiefs, the Rubukul Oruo, were also concerned that tourism was impacting the lake's ecosystems. So they put out a bul, the customary moratorium, which closes off an area to let the species recover. And while there were no crowds at the lake, Sharon and her team got back to researching.
And we noticed that during the drought, when there was very little rainwater, the golden jellyfish was affected by it too. Yeah, even though they were in the lake, we could see that we were not finding any larger sizes.
They charted the lake's temperature using a floating weather station in the middle of the lake.
We have it at different depths. We're measuring water temperature. So we're monitoring the water temperature consistently, continuously throughout the year.
The golden jellyfish have two main life stages. In the early life stage, they are in polyp form, only 1 to 2 millimeters in size. They live deep down, embedded on the sides of the lake in cooler waters. These polyps produce young baby medusa forms, which, when fully grown, are in the mushroom-like state that you normally see in the water. But Sharon and her team found the baby medusa weren't growing into their full adult sizes.
The lake basically went bipolar on us. It went, oh, it's cold, cold. Now we're going to be hot. And it's so hot, everything's going to die. So all the golden jellyfish died.
And while the medusa jellyfish aren't able to survive the warming waters, Sharon has found over the years that the polyps are a completely different story. They stay embedded, deep down, dormant, biding their time until the temperature drops, and then they can reproduce again.
We've tried growing them in our lab, and sometimes things don't work out, and the water quality drops and it's really bad in our little petri dishes, and the polyps are still alive. They survive. They just won't die. So these polyps in the lake, they're hardy. They'll survive.
But as climate change worsens, the El Niño and La Niña weather patterns are getting more intense and are becoming more frequent, meaning there is less time for the jellyfish population to recover before another warming event hits the lake. For now, though, Sharon says the polyps are hanging on and some medusa are surviving.
It's very specific to temperature. If it's too hot, we won't see that many golden medusa. If it's cool enough, we start to see the 1 centimeter medusa swimming around. And at the last monitoring that we did in May, we saw golden jellyfish of different sizes, so really large ones to really small ones. So that's an indication that the population is growing and that they're surviving into their larger size.
This means there is a small chance that I might get to see a fully grown medusa when I head out to Jellyfish Lake.
And to hear that full story and to find out what Sophie Lee discovers at Jellyfish Lake in Palau, tune in to Pacific Scientific at 9 a.m. PNG time here on ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now turning our attention to sport now. 2 years ago, Tonga won the Men's World Rugby Sevens Challenger Series and came within touching distance of joining their Pacific neighbours Fiji among the elite. But now the team is on the verge of extinction, and so is Tonga's National Women's Sevens side. As is so often the case in Pacific sport, it all comes down to money. And for the Tonga Rugby Union, funds are in very short supply. The union's focus is on the men's and women's 15s, and for the Sevens teams to continue, a new source of income has to be found. The TRU's Chief Executive Aisia Aholele says a final decision has yet to be taken, but he's frustrated that his organisation has been left in the dark about World Rugby's future plans for the Sevens setup.
I haven't been informed of anything in regards to changes in World Rugby Sevens. I have heard whispers around here there about changes in formats, but we haven't received anything official from World Rugby.
How do you feel about that? Do you feel as though you've been abandoned by World Rugby? I mean, I'm presuming you're not the only nation that hasn't been officially informed, but looking at your own situation, how on earth do you plan if you don't know what it is you're planning for?
Yeah, we have ideas of how to use the Sevens program for development of our performance and our players. But, you know, we're not performing on the field and things are against us, you know. We just feel that, yeah, we're left out pretty much. And there's no direct funding for us for Sevens. Everything's just packed into the 15s. We've been left out in the cold a few times in the past. I think one time when we passed the Challenger Series and qualified to go into the circuit, but that area, they cut the teams to 12. So very unfortunate for, you know, that's been the story for us in the last few years, that everything's been cut from participating right up to funding and everything else. So the way we view Sevens right now is not in good light at the moment.
Are you therefore, as a union, having to consider whether it's feasible to continue with National Sevens teams?
Yes. Absolutely. You know, Tonga doesn't have much in regards to resources, let alone money to invest in Sevens. We don't get separate funding from World Rugby or any other organisations. The funding that we do get is probably from the IOC. Not quite sure, I think it's the Solidarity Fund, but that's minimal to putting a team together, preparation. And we're seriously thinking of not putting a team together for international reasons, because the cost is a lot for a small union like us, you know. And if the teams don't perform, the return on investment, yeah, it's not good. So we're seriously thinking about just cutting our Sevens program altogether.
When would you expect a final decision to be taken on that?
Probably in the next board meeting. I have to put it to the board. Put it to them that in a international stage, we can't help the team, can't put any money through. It's just too much for Tonga Rugby at the moment, especially with our funding, considering insurance, player payments and everything like that. It's very, very hard for us at the moment. I've had to ask the Sevens teams, the management, that they seek funding themselves, that they have to try to be independent and take ownership of the Sevens program. But, you know, that's very hard on them. And it's not their job. It's the union's job. But we don't have the funding. It's a very unfortunate circumstance that we're in. But, you know, that's reality. That if we want to participate, everyone has to help out from the top down, but to the players as well. If you go onto our Facebook page, our Sevens and our under-20s and our women's asking for money along the streets of Nkolofa just to help them. Campaigns, but it's the way it is for us right here in Tonga. And yeah, we'll just have to see what the board says. And if it is cut, then it is cut. But it doesn't mean the Sevens on island is cut. You know, they can still have participate in the Sevens competition, but for international purposes, we're not performing, we're not being targeted as a team to support or invest in. And it's just all downhill for us in Sevens at the moment.
Have you considered seeking support from the Australian government, for example, who seem to be very keen to put money into sport in the Pacific these days and have certainly assisted, for example, Fijiana, the national women's team in Fiji have benefited, the Fijian Andrua have benefited. Might that be a possibility for you to ask for a bit of assistance from them to keep the National Sevens team going?
I haven't really explored that area. There is a lot of funding from the Australian government to support the Tonga rugby holistically, but in Sevens program, no. It might be an avenue, but what I'm getting from Australia is that they've exhausted funding to rugby in general. The only funding that can be sourced from the Australian government is probably if it was government to government requesting funding. But that takes time, and there's government requesting government to support a program that there's no real promise there. Unlike if it was the Fijian team that is always performing and make a request, and then I'm sure the Australian government will grant it. But Tonga doesn't get any separate funding from the Australian government in regards to the Sevens. It will be okay for us to explore that option, but we're not holding our breath on that one.
So as a union, and I think you hinted at this earlier, you feel rather cast out into the wilderness on this, as if nobody seems to want to help you or keep the National Sevens teams going.
It is very, very hard because of the unique circumstances that Tonga Rugby is in at the moment. Our players are not really based on Ireland. The majority of our best players are overseas. So, you know, just getting them together to play is a real, real challenge in itself. And that costs a lot to fly people from here and there and to put them in camp in a foreign land where our currency is minuscule in rates. It's a very hard job to do. We always believe that we'd have talent for rugby, but that's not the end of the journey. And the rest of it has to be investment. But we're on the outside of everything at the moment.
So the TRU's next board meeting could signal the end for Tonga's National Sevens team, unless perhaps a generous benefactor steps in. Well, that was Union's CEO Aisia Aholele on the line from Nuku'alofa, and he was talking to Richard Hewitt. Recapping our top story, Solomon Islands could try to defuse a potentially explosive stoush over Taiwan's participation at the Pacific Islands Forum by excluding China, US and a host of other countries as well. But while this compromise could avoid a conflict, experts say it sets a worrying precedent.
To what degree are non-Pacific Island Forum member countries, to what degree are they influencing very fundamental procedural aspects of the way in which the forum is conducted, namely who gets to attend?
And that's Massey University Associate Professor Anna Poles. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Your news is up next, and up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o toa whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Nisha Footy, hosted by me, Sam Wykes,
and me, Tēnā rau, Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nisian Footy Stars.
Nisian Footy.
Nisian Footy.
Listen to Nisian Footy on your favourite podcast app.